Welcome to Mental Healthy, where we share the stories and expertise of professionals working diligently in the field of mental health. I'm your host today, Dr. Kenyon Knapp.
Welcome to the Mental Healthy Podcast. If this is a first time for you and tuning in and listening, we just welcome you and we hope that you're able to learn something and pull something away from this. If you've been here before, you're probably wondering whose voice this is. This is not Dr. Kenyon Knapp. Actually, we flipped the tables, and he is now the guest, and my name is Dr. Kevin Connor, and I'm the host, and so I'm excited because this is my first time hosting a podcast, and so we're going to take the opportunity to interview Dr. Knapp. He just recently came out with a book, and so we're excited about this book and the opportunity to just ask him a few questions about it, and so that's what this podcast will be about. So thank you for... It's odd for me to probably say this, but thank you for joining us, Dr. Knapp.
Well, thank you. It is funny for me too. I'm so used to being the one doing the interview, and now it being flipped, it's sort of funny. But I have to say, I interview all kinds of cool, interesting people. They do all kinds of neat projects and things, and I enjoy interviewing them. But you know, I actually do a thing or two myself, and so I just had this book come out. It's my first book. And I thought, you know, well, maybe I should get on my own podcast. And I said, oh no, you got to be humble and, you know, don't self-promote or anything. But then I was like, well, good Lord, everybody else that's got a podcast and they do something professional, they share it on their own podcast and all. And so I figured, yeah, it's probably time for me to share something from my own life.
Well, definitely. And actually, now that you brought this up, you said it was your first book.
Yeah.
What brought you to want to write a book?
Well, it's funny. I've been a counseling professor for over 25 years, and I've been in private practice for, you know, over 25 years as well. And I've had this book really in the back of my head for literally over 20 years. And I actually mention it in the book. It's funny. This book has been percolating in my brain for over 20 years, and I actually have early versions of it on my computer where I'd write, you know, 3 or 4 pages, and then I'd get all self-critical and go, oh no, this, and I'd, you know, delete those pages. And it's sort of a bucket list thing in life for me. There's certain things in life I want to do. And so I just said, you know, it's time. I got to get this done. I'm not going to be this young forever. And so I, about 2.5 years ago, I started writing it. One of the faculty in the department, a guy named John Knox, actually encouraged me and connected me with the publisher, which is Whippenstock. They're based out of Oregon. And I did a proposal to them, and they loved it and accepted it. And they gave me a year to do it and to get the book completed. And 2.5 years later, I had it finished. And so I'm grateful. It came out in early June of 2023, the book came out. I'm starting to get some interviews in different places, and so I'm hoping it'll help some people.
Excellent. Now, we keep referring to this project as the book, the book, the book. And I just wanted to note the title, Healthy Depression, which kind of seems like a contradiction, because we don't normally think of depression as being healthy.
Yeah.
Could you kind of just open up with that and help us understand that?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the title is meant to be sort of a contradiction and sort of hopefully catchy. I don't know. The readers can judge that. Yeah. My idea is that, you know, over the years I've worked with literally thousands of clients. Sometimes, you know, clients would come in and they would be depressed about something, and I would hear what they were describing in their life, all the situations and perspectives on the situation and all that. I just would sit there and think to myself, well, it's totally logical that they're depressed. I mean, if I believed that life was meaningless and nihilistic and random, and then I went through a horrible situation, being depressed is like a logical sequence that you come to. But for those of, I know most of our listeners are in the mental health field. People who aren't in the field may not know this, that a lot of times when people come in and they say, oh, I'm depressed, whatever, the knee-jerk reaction of a mental health professional is to go, oh, that's so unfortunate. I'm so sorry you're feeling that way. You know, let's change the way you feel. Let's, you know, oftentimes medicate you. And in some cases, that's needed. You know, I don't want to go to extremes here and overstate my case. Sometimes when a person comes in and they have a nihilistic worldview, they've got horrible life circumstances, they should be depressed. And what we do in the mental health field many times is we medicate them then, and we start treating the symptoms rather than the illness. And one of the points I make in the book is that illness is bad, but symptoms are good, because symptoms lead you to what the crux of the issue actually is. So you can then work on it and try to either improve it or fix it. But I'm saying that in our field, many times we ignore that and we treat the symptoms. And the problem is, if you treat symptoms, you're going to have the problem forever, because you never get to the crux of the issue.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, and I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush, but there's a lot of people in the mental health field that just do that day in and day out and treat the symptoms. In this book, I challenge the readers to self-diagnose. Are we treating the true illness, or are we treating the symptoms? That's really what the book gets into. It's a self-help book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's meant for the general population, and it's it gets a little philosophical, but I try to keep it simple enough that, you know, your average Joe can, you know, connect the dots and figure out things in their own life.
Well, and as you were sharing that, it really brought to mind, you know, in this mental health crisis that we're working through, that we do try to just, oh, let's get rid of all the bad feelings. Let's get rid of all the anger, depression, the sadness. And we really need those in order to understand the happiness, in order to understand the peace. We need that dichotomy to help us see, okay, these are happy times and these are sad times.
That's right.
And I won't know the difference if one's absent.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. I mean, yeah, I mean, the mountaintops in life don't feel like mountaintops unless you've been through the valleys. And what I get at in the book too is that sometimes when you're depressed, it's not a sign of pathology. Sometimes being depressed is a sign of health.
Mm.
Like when you're feeling depressed, it's because there's something wrong. Let me use another analogy, okay? It's like when a person has a fever and they go to the doctor. You know, we often have a fever because there's some kind of bacterial or viral something going on in our body which causes us to have the fever. If all we do is treat the fever and we don't treat the bacterial or viral illness that's in the body, you're not solving anything. And that's what we do many times when we don't treat, you know, the true issue. And we treat depression as bad. Sometimes depression is good, is my point. And depression can lead us. Depression can be fingerprints of what the true issue is, and it can lead you to solving what the true issue is. And so we need to view it that way as mental health professionals, and we need to sort of try to follow that path. And those of you who are listening who really have been practicing for a while know that this is not an exact science. I mean, it's complicated. It takes a lot of discernment, a lot of training, and to really figure all that out. But that's what we're called to do, and that's how we really help people.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I think you do a good job when you jump right in there in the very beginning of the book, challenging people to just ask themselves some questions, because you've got to have some type of mental philosophical basis before you dig into some of these other aspects. So if you could just kind of unpack some of those questions a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, I'm glad to. It's on page 5 in the book, and a little bit later we'll tell you all where you can get the book if you want to. These are classical questions that have been around for thousands of years. And so, you know, some people, when they go, oh, did Aristotle say that or something? You know, they can sort of dismiss it and go, that's just irrelevant or something. But they're not. All these questions are really, they're existential, but they're philosophical questions that everyone has to answer. I mean, all you listeners, all your clients, myself included. And so what the questions are is it's called origin, which is, of course, where do you think you came from? And of course, origin gets at the whole idea of, is there any, you know, purpose or meaning or direction to your life? Or are you random, per se? And if you believe that you're random, there's all kinds of logical ramifications of that belief. The next question is a question of meaning. Why are you here? Is there any meaning or purpose or reason for your life? The next one is morality, what's right and wrong, because all of us have choices and decisions to make in life. And some of those decisions lead to joy and happiness, and others lead to depression. And that's just a reality. And by the way, as I say all this, I'm not sitting here preaching at the reader or the listener saying, this is right and this is wrong. I'm saying that if you counsel thousands of clients like I have, you will see that certain decisions they make on moral issues lead to certain outcomes. And that's just reality. And without me dictating what that is or being preachy, the book isn't preachy. It's really not. The next philosophical question is destiny, which is where are you going? Do you believe you have any future? Because, you know, future involves hope and a sense of what's coming ahead. The next two more questions, worth, do you have any worth? And, of course, I ask that question because we all have bad things that happen to us. And sometimes we internalize like negative self-worth or somebody did something bad to me, therefore I must be a bad person. What sense of worth do you have and where does that come from? What's that based on? Is it based on something that's durable and substantial that's not going to change in your life? Or is it based on something that can change? Like my worth is based on I'm strong or I'm successful in my mm-hmm. business. Or I think I'm intelligent or I'm rich or whatever. And then the last question is identity. Who are you? How do you define yourself? Do you have a sense of identity? How developed is that? Mm-hmm. And of course, these are all the classical meaning of life questions. And so I challenge the reader to answer all of these. And I've actually got a section in the book. It's more of like a workbook kind of format mm-hmm. almost, where it's a fill in the blank kind of thing. And they answer all these questions, and then I've got some follow-up questions, not saying, yes, these are good answers or they're not, but I challenge them to look at how substantial, how meaningful, how coherent are they as far as giving the person that sense of meaning and purpose in life. Mm-hmm. Because when depression comes, having good answers to these questions is a protective factor. You know, if you believe you have meaning and purpose in your life and the hard times come, and they're going to come for all of us, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, every one of us, it's going to be one thing or another. And, you know, most of us will get cancer or something in our life. And so when those hard times come, you know, do you have meaning and purpose is the mm-hmm. question. And my hope is that this book will instigate people to delve into all these questions and, you know, hopefully come up with, maybe they've already got great answers, and if mm-hmm. they do, good for you. Yay. but if you don't, you know, I mean, there's still life going on here. Let's figure it out. You know, let's ask ourselves how substantial and meaningful are my responses.
And it's interesting you say that because it's our current culture, and I think we can almost in a very general way say internationally, mm-hmm. People, groups, and individuals are really searching for the answers to these questions. Mm-hmm. They're wondering, you know, who am I? And not to mm-hmm. get into all the politics of it, but just that, who am I? What's my value? What do I believe as far as morals? And so in your book, you're really beginning to help someone unpack that in light of depression, mm-hmm. really.
Yeah, absolutely. Because all of these things, every one of these factors impacts depression. And I'm not saying it explains all of it. So, mm-hmm. you know, listeners, please don't take a little snippet of what I'm saying and apply it to everything. I mean, I do believe there's some depression that's organic mm-hmm. and, you know, our neurochemistry gets messed up and you've got great meaning and purpose in your life, but you still feel depressed. You know, that happens. But for a lot of people, though, having this meaning and purpose in life, you know, impacts their depression.
And you keep using that phrase, meaning and purpose in life, and that just reminds me of a classic writer, Viktor Frankl, and he has an amazing book, which should be, if you don't have that book, that would be the second next book to get. Obviously, Dr. Naps is the first. how did that come into your writing?
Well, I've been a big fan of Viktor Frankl for a long time. Yeah, his book, Man's Search for Meaning, of course, has sold millions and millions of copies around the world. It's been translated into God knows how many languages. And, you know, his most famous quote in his book was, "He who has a why to live can bear with almost any how." That's true. Now, I don't necessarily come to all the same conclusions Viktor Frankl does, but his point there, "He who has a why to live can bear with almost any how," is really true. Having that meaning and purpose and sense of there's something redemptive in the hard times in life does make it more bearable. I admit very from the beginning of this book that I come from a Christian perspective in this book, a Christian worldview, or I aspire to that. And that the question he asks, you know, "He who has a why to live can bear with almost any how," it reminds me a lot of Romans chapter 5, verses 3 through 5, where it talks about, you know, we can bear our sufferings or even have joy in our sufferings because we know that the testing of our faith develops perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. And so from a Christian worldview, if you actually believe those verses, that creates a resilient mindset. It creates a post-traumatic growth kind of mindset where when hard times come, you just don't, you know, go, "Oh, well, life is terrible now." Because, I mean, some people who are more nihilistic or other worldviews, they'll have bumper stickers on their car. You know, they'll say, like, you know, I won't use the exact words, but "Junk happens and then you die."
Yeah.
I've seen them. You may have seen those bumper stickers before. And of course, that's a nihilistic worldview. And when you have that worldview and then hard times come, you're going to get way depressed. Whereas for somebody like me, when something really difficult happens, one of the first questions I ask myself is, you know, how is God using this in my life? Mm-hmm. How is God growing me? How is God changing me? Why might God have allowed this to occur in my life? And every one of those questions potentially leads to an answer that makes the suffering meaningful.
Mm.
And it makes it like, oh, okay, well, God allowed me to go through this to make me grow in this way, or for me to learn this, or for me to be more empathetic with so-and-so. It takes the junk in our lives and it redeems it.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it bearable. Is it fun? No, it's still terrible.
Right.
Life stinks sometimes. But when the hard times come, it makes it a lot more bearable. And I've seen that over and over again in my life, and I've seen it over and over again in the lives of thousands of clients. And so if that makes life better for people, I want all the listeners and all the readers and all my clients to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as mental health professionals, we try to make our clients' lives better. You know, they are better when there's meaning and purpose coming from hard times.
Right. And it seems like even that verse gives this process to hope. Hope's not something that you can just pick up and say, "Oh, I've got hope." There's these answers to these questions that you've posed that someone has to think through, mm-hmm, and persevere before they can really say, "Okay, yes, now I have hope."
Exactly. And it's a process. Like you're saying, it is a process. And so even viewing hard times as a process rather than an event makes it like there's a learning that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a growth that goes on. It's not just junk.
Yeah.
There's something that grows from it. And I try to create that mindset, or I try to offer that mindset in my clients. And over again, it helps. I sometimes share the kind of work I've done for the last 15 years. My specialty area has been crisis counseling. And I've worked with refugees, human trafficking victims, both work and sex trafficking, all different things. In the last 15 years, I've been in India, Uganda, Israel, the West Bank, Colombia, and South America, Haiti, a number of places around the world. And I find that this kind of perspective of searching for meaning and purpose in life and the mindset that allows finding meaning and purpose in life is what sustains people.
Hmm.
When I was in Haiti after the earthquake in 2005, I believe it was, or was it 2010? I'm sorry, my dates are a little sloppy in my head. But after the huge earthquake in Haiti, I was there just not too long afterwards. And I remember I was working with, I was doing crisis and trauma training with pastors and public school teachers. And I remember there was this one pastor I was working with, and his entire family died during the earthquake. His concrete house collapsed on his family when the earthquake occurred. And of course, he was extremely traumatized and grieving horribly. But he would tell me that, you know, the idea that even though he was grieving, you know, he believed in the center of his soul that God allowed it for some purpose. Mm-hmm. Some, he said, even as he was trying to help people in his congregation, the fact that he had been through trauma allowed him to relate to the people in his congregation. Mm. And they knew that he had been through horrible stuff. So they felt safe to come to him. They felt like, oh, you get it, you know, and the fact that he got it made him qualified. Hmm. And so pain and suffering qualifies us. It makes us more empathetic. It makes us really get it when other people go through hard times. And he believed that. Mm-hmm. And I saw this Haitian pastor do amazing ministry with his congregation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was this American that flew in there to do this training stuff. But I mean, the people that are really there, they were the ones that were really doing the good stuff.
Yeah.
And it was, I was amazed at how God worked through this guy. And that's the way it is. When you give God the worst experiences in your life, he'll work with whatever you give him. And that's the perspective of this book, is that God will work with what you give him. And of course, that's messy.
Yeah.
but so I try to, I was telling you even before we started this podcast today that I try to operationalize logotherapy. Like Viktor Frankl came up with this theory called logotherapy, where he tries to help people find meaning and purpose in life. Mm-hmm. And I like it. There's a lot of good in it, but it's fairly highfalutin philosophy stuff.
Yeah.
And I try to sort of, I don't want to say dumb it down, but I try to simplify it a little bit in my book and sort of operationalize that process of finding meaning and purpose so that the readers can hopefully have something helpful.
Exactly. You're just making it in a much more practical and reader-focused basis. In fact, I noticed you have four different chapters, mm-hmm. and as you were sharing about this Haitian pastor, he sounds like he would fit in one of those four groups. If you could just tell me a little bit more about those four groups and how you would delineate them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of one of the little unique things about the book, maybe. Mm-hmm. I've got four chapters, and they're based on these four quadrants, and there's these two categories I have people grade themselves on. And the question is, are you depressed? Either yes or no. And then do you have a sense of meaning and purpose in your life? Yes or no. And so the four categories are, like, the first one is those who are depressed and have meaning and purpose in their life, those who are not depressed and have meaning and purpose in their life, those who are don't have meaning and purpose in their life and they are depressed. And then finally, I don't mean to confuse the listeners, but those who don't have meaning and purpose in their life and they're not depressed. And so what the readers do is they read through these different questions and then they self-assess, yeah, I've got a pretty good sense of meaning and purpose in life, or mm-hmm. maybe I'm sort of a little fudgy on it, or no, I really don't. I'm being honest with myself. I don't know what the heck I believe about all these, you know, philosophical questions. And then, of course, the next question is, are you depressed or not? I've got chapters that match each one of these categories. Mm-hmm. And I sort of delve into, with each group, challenges for each group, you know, ways they can help themselves. And I try to make it practical for the reader. And once again, you know, this is the reader self-diagnosing. Mm-hmm. It's not me saying, oh, you have meaning and purpose, or no, you don't, or something like that. It's not me imposing anything on a client. It's the client answering basic questions and then saying, yeah, here's where I'm at. And I'll be honest, I've run this past a lot of people so far, and it's been really helpful so far, and I hope it is for even more folks. And so those are pretty much the categories.
So when you say depressed, because we'll so often use that terminology. Oh, I'm so depressed, man. I'm just down. I'm depressed. When you're using it in this book, how would you kind of operationalize? We mentioned operational definition. How would you kind of define that for the reader as their self, as they're trying to self-diagnose? I mean, they, what is it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, those of us who are in the mental health fields, you know, psychology, counseling, social work, pastoral counseling, at least marriage and family, you know, we have diagnosis, you know, the DSM, and we can diagnose people with clinical depression or bipolar and all this stuff. Yeah, it could be those more clinical ways of looking at depression, but I don't want to limit it to that, honestly. I mean, you know, all of us go through ups and downs in life. And so I really leave it up to the reader.
Okay.
I mean, we could sit here and talk about what is clinical depression. And of course, you know, people lose a sense of meaning and purpose in their life. They take less joy and pleasure in things that they enjoyed previously. We call that anhedonia. They will a lot of times self-isolate. Mm-hmm. They might start sleeping more. They might start medicating in different ways with alcohol or drugs or trying to escape through sleeping or other ways, addictions. You know, people might get into gambling to try to cope with all kinds of other addictions to try to deal with the feelings they have. So, you know, we could talk about depression in that way, but we can also talk about less clinical forms of depression that people have. And so wherever the listeners are or wherever your clients are, I think they can sort of judge for themselves how clinical or how severe that is.
Which is really brings it to a value as far as a self-help book, because that person can say, well, yeah, I feel like I'm in this position, while someone else might be looking, well, you don't have any reason to be depressed. And, you know, we often will have that dialogue. But as a self-help book, it says, well, no, if you're feeling this way, maybe these are some of the things you should think through.
Absolutely. And I should say this too. When people are depressed, I don't want to make them feel shame about depression either.
Yeah, definitely.
Or feel like stigmatized or something like that. And I give a number of examples in the book in all the different chapters about sometimes biblical characters who maybe had their life all together, but were feeling depressed. I mean, I talk about, for example, like David in the Bible. He was called a man after God's own heart. And yet all through the Psalms, there's these phrases over and over again, why so downcast, O my soul? And that sounds like something close to depression to me, you know, and there's other examples of other prophets in the Old Testament who were depressed and things like that. And so I give examples of where people can be depressed and everything's right in their life. There's nothing wrong. It's just, we're in a fallen world and we're fallen beings. And sometimes we get depressed and we've got tons of meaning and purpose in our life. So, you know, listeners, don't feel bad if you're depressed. I mean, you know, maybe there is a philosophical reason, or maybe it's just neurological or neurochemical. So we don't really know.
Yeah. And you mentioned a number of different countries that you've been to and the opportunity to do a variety of different work in those countries, which is a great wealth of information and experience to draw upon. So would you say that even though this is an English book, its principles really do span the globe?
They do. And, you know, I dream of this book, you know, going beyond English and, you know, hopefully being translated into other languages at some point. But a lot of the principles I share in the book are not just opinions or philosophical stuff. I've got a whole chapter on evidence-based treatments for depression. And I've got, you know, well over, I think it's 120 some odd citations in the book of references and all kinds of research backing it up. And of course, all of these treatments that I recommend have been applied all around the world in multiple contexts and languages and all that. And so, yeah, there's a lot of treatments that are proven worldwide, and they're not idiosyncratic to America or the English speaking world. Yeah.
And so, yeah, tell me a little bit about that evidence-based piece, because you worked that in chapter 8. You know, we recognize that depression is a very well-researched subject matter. And so then how do you work that into your book and how does it fit, I guess?
Sure. Yeah, I've got a big list, basically, like a laundry list of all these evidence-based approaches. And some of them are things that you have to do with a therapist, and some of them are things you can do on your own. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just want to be upfront about that with the listeners, that it's not all completely do it on your own kind of thing, because we're really not meant to do life by ourselves.
Right. I mean,
God created us for relationships. The most well-established approach to a lot of things is cognitive behavior therapy. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of versions of cognitive behavior therapy when it comes to treating depression. So I list a number of those. Those of you who live up in parts of the world like Alaska know that light therapy can be helpful with like seasonal affective disorder. Mm-hmm. I've got, you know, a section on that. Maybe that may be the case. I talk about exercise. I sometimes in classes I'll talk about how, you know, through exercise we can become our own pharmacist. We can exercise and create endorphins, which are just as good as Zoloft or Prozac or some of these other antidepressant medications. And a good psychiatrist will, when they're treating depression, prescribe exercise as well as a medication if need be. And so I describe that further, you know, what that involves. I talk about mindfulness meditation. A lot of research shows that can be effective, because what people do when they become depressed is they ruminate and they think and they just keep rehashing in their brain what they're depressed about. And so with mindfulness, what you try to do is you try to change what they're ruminating about. And because like in the Bible, it says faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. Mm-hmm. Well, you're sort of hearing yourself think over and over again about, you know, something that's depressing or something that's hopeful. There's a lot of research that what you do deliberative rumination on helps alleviate depression. I go into more creative approaches, like music therapy is one thing I talked about. Other more contemporary therapies like acceptance and commitment therapy for depression, behavior activation therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, Christian accommodative CBT. There's a number of other approaches I get into in the book, and I don't want to bore the listeners with all the dry academic stuff, but there's a whole large chapter on you know, evidence-based approaches. So it's not just a philosophical book. There's some academic, you know, research stuff thrown in there as well.
Certainly. And it seems like it is a good blend of that philosophical, that practical, but then also that evidence-based, which in turn, I mean, as a book, it's not, for those of our listeners that are in that professional helping careers, this isn't a replacement of the field or of individuals. There's still the value of having that relationship that we talked about that we're created for. Mm-hmm. But this is another tool to help clients or help individuals maybe begin to process some of that stuff. And they might be better clients when they come in for a counseling session.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, I hope that this book could be an assistant in the process of therapy with clients. And I know for me over the years, I do a lot of bibliotherapy where I'll tell my clients, hey, read this book as part of our therapeutic process. And, you know, come on in here the next session and let's talk about the next chapter. And it often helps them from week to week sort of have a little more of a process to it than, which helps. So yeah, I hope that might be the case. We'll have to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, definitely. And it really can be used in a very wide array of situations, you know, to the person grabbing it off the shelf, to the client, opportunity for a professional to just to be reminded of some of the philosophical questions that we're all working through and maybe incorporate into the session, which kind of brings me to one of our last questions. You know, I mentioned that person getting it off the shelf.
Yeah.
How in the world can someone get a hold of a copy of this book?
Oh, sure. Well, it's on all the major outlets, but when I say that, I should probably list a few. I mean, it's on Barnes & Noble's website, Amazon, Wipfenstock. I should spell that. It's WIPFSTOCK.com. It's on christianbook.com, which used to be CBD, Christian Book Distributor, but now it's christianbook.com. And it's in a number of different formats as well. I mean, you can get a hardback copy, the soft cover. It's in ebook version, Kindle version. So there's a lot of different formats and whatever people are most comfortable with.
I'm going to throw one. Is it going to be an audiobook coming out? Are you going to read it to us?
Well, I'd be flattered if you know, the publisher wants to do that. We're not there yet, but I'd be glad to do that. That'd be fun.
And then follow-up question, do you have another book idea on the horizon?
I do. I actually have a few, but I'll sort of tease the audience here a little bit and say that, you know, we'll see when, you know, Lord willing, that might happen at some point in the future. But yeah, I've got a number of ideas in my head. And you know, it's funny doing a book for the first time. There's a process for me in all mm-hmm. this, too, that I've learned. It was almost like doing a dissertation. It was a scary thing, and I hadn't done one before. And I sort of got nervous, and I mentioned I took longer than was the original plan to get it done. But it's like when you do research for the first time, it's all scary and intimidating, or doing statistics. You go, oh, yeah. I'm scared. But then once you do it, you're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. And so, yeah, I hope that in the coming years, I'll, you know, do a few more books. And I think I've overcome a lot of my own anxieties and fears, you know, doing this first book. And hopefully God will use this book or mm-hmm. other future books to help somebody. And if that happens, I'm grateful.
Well, that's wonderful. And I'd be fine flipping the tables on you and interviewing you for those books as well. Is there anything else that you would want our listeners to know?
I'd just say, you know, check this out. If you're debating like, would this be helpful or not? I really don't know. If you go to a lot of those websites like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, they actually let you read like the first two or three pages of it. And so I'd encourage you just to check it out. You know, read those first two or three pages. And if it seems like something that would help you or your clients, you know, go ahead and get it. You know, and I'm not saying that because I'm getting rich off this. I'll let the listeners know I get about 6% of the books, you know, the cost of the books. And, you know, most of it goes to the publisher. And that's okay. I'm a first book guy. I'm a nobody, you know, and so, and that's okay. And my goal here, honestly, isn't to get rich anyway. My goal is influence. Mm-hmm. My goal is that, you know, God would hopefully use this book to help somebody and help them figure out a few things in their life so that whatever level of depression they're running into, they'll cope with it better and, you know, enjoy the life that God gave them more.
Excellent.
And that's about all I can aspire to.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. And I'll tell you, the best compliment you could give him is not only to buy the book, but then to pass it along. Because then you're replicating that desire to influence, that desire to help others come to a better understanding of who they are and how they can have hope in a world that does have so many challenges. So thank you all for listening, and we look forward to our next episode.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Mental Healthy. Please be sure to subscribe for more episodes and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. You can find this podcast on all your favorite podcast platforms. We hope you join us next time for more on Mental Healthy.
Music for this podcast is licensed under Creative Commons by Excel Music Publishing at freemusicpublicdomain.com.